everybody. I'm Karen Hartglass, and you're listening to It's All About Food. Here we are. It's December 9th, 2014. Nice, wet, chilly weather here in New York City. Don't go outside. No matter what you're wearing, you're going to be soaked. Believe me, I've tried it. Anyway, let's jump into today's program. I have so much to talk about. And first, I want to bring on my guest, Sprout Man, Steve Meyerowitz. We're going to be talking about his newest book, The 7-Day Just Juice Diet. As you probably know, Steve Meyerowitz, the Sprout Man, is known worldwide for his pioneering work on sprouting, juicing, fasting, and detoxification. Steve, are you with me?
Absolutely. And love listening to you, and great to be back again.
Do you know, I had you on exactly 1 year ago. I was just checking my notes, and you were talking about springtime in December.
Well, for those of us who live in the cold, dark, rainy Northeast, we need a source of fresh greens that we don't have to import from thousands of miles away.
That's right. And December's a good time to start talking about it. You know, we're kind of lucky where some of the hardier greens, like my favorite kale, can actually grow into the wintertime, November, December. But January, February gets a little tricky for fresh greens.
And, yes, well, you know, the one green that can last the entire winter, it's wheatgrass.
Oh, but that's when you're growing it inside.
No, even the grass that grows outdoors comes right back in the spring. It overwinters. One of the few veggies that can tolerate that cold and that snow.
But they're not growing in the winter, but they come back.
Absolutely. They survive the long, cold winter. And, you know, interestingly enough, of course, it's not a vegetable that you find on the produce stand, but it is indeed a vegetable if you're a ruminant animal like a cow or a horse or a sheep or a deer or a goat. You know, it's a green vegetable, and the beauty, of course, for us is if we happen to have a juicing machine, is we can extract the nutritional medicine, the potent nutrient value of that green vegetable, because the juicing machine allows us to digest it, whereas it would be too hard for us to chew.
The juicing machine acts like a double gut, like some of these other animals have.
Yeah, actually, the ruminant animals have that kind of multiple regurgitation, and you know, it takes a lot to break down all that heavy fiber. That's the only thing that's a problem with things like alfalfa and wheatgrass and clover and buckwheat. All of these veggies that are so potent, the farmers replant them to put more nitrogen, more protein in the soil.
There's just so many things.
Too fibrous.
I mean, that's what's wonderful about eating buckwheat, because the plant is actually good to put back in the soil, so we can get the seeds and enjoy them, and then the rest of the plant goes back to nourish the soil.
Exactly, and for all those people concerned today about being gluten-free, buckwheat actually has zero relationship to wheat. It's just in the name.
That's right. It's a pseudo-grain, because it's not a grain.
Exactly.
Yeah, and exactly. It's delicious. The first thing I wanted to ask you, and I've already had a million questions, but what I really wanted to ask you first was the hat that you're wearing on the cover of your book. Now, is that a new Sprout Man fashion statement? Was it specially designed for you? Can others get it, or was it just created for that shoot?
Well, you know, I'm not a seamstress. But I am, you know, an artistic type. So I pulled together the material and the grass, which is a kind of plastic grass that you can find now in a lot of shopping windows. Mm-hmm. Now they all have plastic grass to you know, represent their earthiness of that store. So I pulled together that kind of grass and the material and brought it to my favorite seamstress, and we made a hat, and I have a tie, and you know, it's all part of sending out a message.
Okay, I'm looking at the I didn't notice it on the tie as much as but I think there's little glimmers of it here. If anybody's wondering,
yes,
what I'm talking about, the Sprout Man has a lovely black cap on, and it's got this fringy wheatgrass stuff in the front. Lovely contrast of green and black. If you go to responsibleeatingandliving.com, you can see his smiling little face with the cap on right away, or just get the book, Just Juice Diet, and you'll see it. But
yeah,
I think
actually
you're...
on my website, you can actually flip through the book or, you know, a good portion of it.
Oh, so that's SproutMan.com.
Yeah.
Very good. Okay, so I thought that was very important to discuss the fashion statement with wheatgrass. You know,
well,
you have to be
well,
proud.
Yes. Those of us in the health food world, sometimes we have to do whatever it takes to draw attention to our very important topic.
That's right, and I noticed. We should wear our food. Maybe. Okay, so here we are. You have this lovely book, Just Juice Diet, 7 days. And the first question, it's an obvious question, I think. I'm talking to you, the very healthy Sprout Man who knows it all and does it all when it comes to eating green and juicing and sprouting and detoxing. Why would you need to do a 7-day Just Juice fast?
Well, you know, Karen, we are accumulators. We are absorbers. And even if we eat a beautiful vegetarian, vegan diet and strive to be as organic as we can, we're absorbing pollutants from our environment. I was in Toronto last weekend, and in the hotel room and the shower, I was inhaling all of the chlorine.
Oh, I know.
You know, you go to a hotel, and you know, and the inhalants, the outgassing of chlorine, are carcinogenic. Chloroform is one of them. All these chlorogenic compounds. So, and at the gas station, you know, I'm one of those who has no shame at all in holding my nose, you know, when one hand is pumping.
Mm-hmm.
So. Because that's benzene, that's a group 1 carcinogen. I mean, we're taking in a lot from our environment, whether it's by mouth or by skin or by breath. So we need to take some time every once in a while, just like people need to clean their house periodically and clean their car and mow their lawn. We need to take care of our insides. I like to say they are my closest friends, my liver, my gallbladder, my intestines, my lungs. So, you know, I like to take a week off and just devote the attention to my body, to taking care of my body, which for most of us, the majority of the year, we're pushing ourselves. You know, we're busy. We ignore our health. We grab food here and there. You know, we don't always make the best choices. But, you know, it's just like you would do spring cleaning for your house. It's good to take a week to do spring cleaning for your body.
That makes a lot of sense. Now, I probably shouldn't say that I love the smell of gasoline, but I have a thing for those organic, aromatic chemicals that are really not good for us. But I like.
And what about tobacco smoke? I used to like my dad
no.
used to smoke pipes, and that has a kind of nostalgic memory for me.
Oh, sure.
But I know it's not good.
Right. Pipes are better than cigarettes, but yeah, not good. So some things that smell kind of good are not necessarily good for us, and we don't live in a natural world. Even in the natural world, there's plenty of toxins, but in our especially unnatural world, they're everywhere. Like you said, the chlorine, it, with our water, sometimes it's not as obvious as other times. There's more chlorine from time to time, and it can really be overwhelming sometimes.
And in big cities like New York, there's always fluoridation, which we have to deal with.
I know.
This universal application of fluoride. Now, even if you happen to be a believer in dental fluoride, there is still no reason why they have to force it upon the entire population. You can always go and buy a toothpaste. You can always go to the drugstore and get a fluoride treatment and put it on yourself or get it from your dentist.
Right. So what do we do with our water with fluoride in it?
Well, you know, there's two things that remove fluoride that are known and proven to remove fluoride, and that's the process of distillation and the process of reverse osmosis.
Mm. Well, everybody I think who listens to me knows I'm a big fan of distilling water. And you know, I believe in tap water. I'm very glad we have it. I'm glad water comes to my apartment and I have the ability to use it for drinking and cooking and cleaning and whatever, but I would like it cleaner than it is at the tap. So that's why I distill my water. Yeah. All right, let's jump into the Sprout Man 7-Day Just Juice diet. And so we need to take some time and treat ourselves nicely and have this ability to detox. So how does that happen on a just juice diet?
Well, first off, just by taking a week off of solid food, we are allowing our body to go through to commence its natural cleansing process. So that simple act in and of itself is essentially a form of fasting, which is ancient natural medicine. I mean, this is the kind of thing that you can find in every major religion. You can find ancients like, you know, Jesus fasted and Moses fasted and Muhammad fasted and Buddha fasted. I mean, it was part not just a spiritual cleansing, but it is a physical, the mind and the body and the spirit are all integrated. So that cleansing of the body also has as part of a spiritual cleanse as well. Sadly, we don't do much fasting in our modern world.
Mm-mm. And people have this scared reaction when you even mention the word fast. Like, oh, what are you going to do? You're going to starve.
So the nice thing is that we're not doing water fasting here. I'm promoting a juice fast. And the difference is that juice is giving us calories and it's giving us nutrition. Mm. And in fact, it's giving us better nutrition than when we're eating our normal diet. And I'll have to explain that.
Mm-hmm.
The reason is, I mean, you might love broccoli and know how nutritionally valuable broccoli is to have in your diet, but there's no way you could consume, say, a pound of broccoli. It would just be impossibly to digest. And but we can take a pound of broccoli and put it through our juicing machine, and it'll yield an 8-ounce glass of juice, and that juice will be digested in seconds.
Mm.
So we can drink the nutritional value of a pound of broccoli, but we cannot consume it.
So why wouldn't we want to live on just juice all the time?
Well, why wouldn't we?
Yeah, why wouldn't we?
Well, there are some people who live on juice for long periods of time. I know in my crazy youth, I went for 100 days just on juice. I have some students who write me and tell me that they've gone for that 100 days as well. And so it's doable, because the nutrition is coming in there. And because there's two things going on, really. Number one, we're resting our body because the digestive organs don't have to interact with solid food. Because, you know, they say that 80% of our energy is consumed in the process of digestion, assimilation, and elimination.
Mm.
So just by taking a vacation from that process, our pancreas is not secreting enzymes, our liver is not secreting, our gallbladder, our stomach. So all of these organs can now rest and do some rebuilding and repair work. And you're saving all of that energy, but you're getting a concentrated form of nutrition from food without the effort of digestion. So it's a kind of double win-win there in that you get the nutrition without the work.
Save energy. Go on a juice fast.
Now, the interesting thing here is you might think that, well, you know, you're going to be starving the whole time, but the truth is the enzymes, like the salivary enzymes in your mouth, when your mouth starts to water, when you get hungry for food, that sends these neural messages down to your organs like your pancreas and your liver and your stomach, and you start to secrete enzymes there. And that is what initiates the appetite. And once you stop the consumption of solid food, those enzyme secretions start to die off. Those valves shut down. And when you are no longer secreting those enzymes, you no longer get that drive, you no longer get that appetite and that yearning for food. So you're like standing there and you're totally amazed that you're not interested in food.
Yeah, it's a fascinating thing, and people won't believe it until they try it. And I have several fasting experiences. I did do a 3-week water-only fast, I think it was in 2000, and it's amazing how after a couple of days you're not hungry. And then I thought years later that I like the idea of doing these occasional juice fasts or whatever, but it's really important to know what you're doing, and that's why your book is so informative, because it goes through everything you need to know, not just during the fast, but before, during, and after, and all that's so important, because I had I was dumb one time, and I didn't prepare before the fast. I went out and had like some big oily, greasy Thai food, and then the next day I thought, okay, I'm not going to eat. And everything stopped. Just major plug. And you talk a lot about the importance of keeping things moving.
Yeah, well, you know, just like you say, your experience, I mean, I had the same experience. You know, you think that it's an easy thing to do. You just fast, you just stop eating. But, you know, and it can be done that way. But, you know, I want to squeeze out the maximum amount of detox possible in the shortest amount of time. And in order to optimize the value of these 7 days, I want us to do some things, some extra things that will promote detoxification and also keep us comfortable. Because like you, I did everything wrong when I first started out doing this because, like I said, you just have to stop eating, right?
Mm.
Well, not exactly. I'm working very hard in this program. I set it up so that every day we're drinking a colon cleanser drink so that we keep our intestines open and flowing. Very important. We're not having solid food going through them, so we need a substitute for that. And the colon cleanses are actually mucilaginous drinks, and they are insoluble fiber, so they don't turn on the digestive system whatsoever. They just move through like a locomotive, and they do a cleaning because the colon walls, the intestinal walls, are filled with pockets and twists and turns and diverticuli, and they kind of puff them open. They blow them open a little bit, and in that process, as they move through, they're dragging things off the walls and carrying them out of your body, down and out. So the colon cleanser drink is it's 25% of what we drink on a typical day. And then the other drinks we drink, well, one of them is for the liver. So that drink is a lemon-based drink. And we can have it hot and we can have it cold, but it's very important to keep working on the liver and the gallbladder every day. And it's not just through the drinks. We could actually do get a liver massage. We could do a hot pack on the liver area with some castor oil, which is 100-year-old, you know, natural medicine. But these kinds of things actually do work to stimulate the liver, to open up the gallbladder, to allow it to release its stones or its calcified material that will become a stone. So we're working on these important organs, and we're also working on the lungs, which is why I recommend that we do 30 minutes a day minimum of aerobic activity. Could be anything from walking to dancing to trampolining to light jogging. It's not a week for muscle building exercise, but it is a week for exercise that increases the heart rate, increases blood flow, increases lymphatic drainage. Yoga, I always call yoga an innercise rather than an exercise because it squeezes the liver and it squeezes the intestines, and you know that's the kind of action we need, that kind of internal action to create movement, because by increasing movement is where we will increase detoxification. So the program includes elements like this to promote detoxification and to maximize the most we can get out of these 7 days.
All right, I want to go back to that those colon cleanser drinks, and you mentioned the mucilage. Now, there's a little yuck factor for me when I hear that. And I use flax seeds a lot when I bake, and I know how when you mix them with water, they get this gooey egg white consistency. And what's interesting is even though we use the flax seeds to simulate a binder in eggs, that slimy stuff is really doing something very different in flax than what it's doing in the egg. I mean, the egg is giving us things that aren't good for us, cholesterol and who knows what, and the flax slime is picking everything up and taking it out.
Yes, and that is also why I'm one of the few people who is vocal against the overuse of flaxseed in cooking because it's a binder. And if I'm making a very nutritious dish, the last thing I want to do is envelop those nutrients and put them in a carrying agent that's going to move them right out of my body.
I'm glad you brought that up because I was wondering exactly about that, because we're told to eat flax and we're told it has lots of anti-cancer fighting properties. It gives us, has these lignans in it that the seed does, not oil, and that fights against breast cancer and other cancers, and it also is loaded with omega-3 fatty acids. So is there a balance, or is there a way we should eat flax and not eat flax to get the good from it and not have it take all the nutrients with it? I'm confused.
Well, yeah, yes, it is a confusing topic. The thing about those lignans that are part of the fiber, the insoluble fiber, mm-hmm. is that it's healthy to have fiber in the diet. Fiber is an anti-cancer treatment. And so having a flaxseed drink, say in a smoothie, I think is a great way to get that fiber in us and give us the benefit of the anti-cancer benefits. And flaxseed oil gives us the omega-3-6 benefits. So I'm all for consuming those in that form, but I don't really use it much in cooking. And if I was going to use it as a binder, I would want to be sure that it was in a kind of a minimal percentage of the recipe so that it wouldn't have an overpowering effect. And in the drinks, in the colon cleanser drinks that I recommend, I don't recommend mixing the flax with the fresh, raw, squeezed juices because I don't want to bind up those nutrients. So for those drinks, I'm using coconut water or some other your favorite juice. But that could be, that's the only time I'm willing to use a bottle juice that recipe, because I don't want to trap the fresh squeezed juice nutrients.
Mm. Fascinating. All right, so do you think December is a good time for this juice diet, or do we have fun and we go through the holidays and then we clean out?
Well, you know, Karen, I do this four times a year. I'm kind of lucky. I'm a lucky guy because one of the perks of my job is I get to lead groups of people on these cleanses. And I, of course, it's a great excuse to do it too. Mm-hmm. So I join everybody, and one of the best time, the biggest time of the year is in the middle of the winter. It's in January. This year it's January 5th, and I call it the post-holiday cleanse. Mm. And last year I had 46 people do it with me, and, you know, where they partied during the holidays, and they really felt that it was a great way to start off the new year, feeling good about your body and cleaning yourself out. And so it was it's a pretty popular time of year to do the cleanse, even though it's cold up here in the Northeast.
Well, here's the danger, if there is any danger, that I think about when I talk about fasts, when I read about fasts, when I hear people that are going on fasts. Some people, I think, abuse the fast. Now, I understand that we live in an unnatural world. We're exposed to all kinds of toxins. It's great to give our body a break. But I know some people that use it as an opportunity to clean themselves out, and then they go back to all their bad habits, and they think that's okay.
Well, that's the problem with diets in general, is when the diet's over, people go back to their bad habits. And so this is a problem, but it's more of a problem of discipline and a problem of psychology than it is a problem of the diet itself. I find that people feel so good on this cleanse that they don't go back 100% to the diet that they had before. And especially if you repeat this cleanse, say, twice a year, which is pretty common. I see that a lot. I see a lot of repeat students. And the more you repeat, the you tend to stay cleaner longer. The pounds tend to stay off longer and don't return as quickly. And the old diet does change over time. The more you do this kind of cleaning out, and the better you feel about yourself, you never go back 100% to the previous diet. Of course, if this is just something you do once and you haven't done it for the last 5 years, then of course we migrate back to whatever diet, you know, we want. But if you do this on a regular basis, which is kind of what I suggest, once or twice a year, it kind of keeps you in check. It kind of resets your diet every time you do it. And then you have a decision to make as to what you're going to fall back to. And I like, as part of this book, in one of the ending chapters, I talk about, well, what kinds of things can we do on a regular basis when we're back eating a full diet? What kinds of things can we do? Can we do some things weekly? Like, can we go on one day a week just doing those colon cleanser drinks? Or one day a week just doing juices, or maybe, you know, once a month. Or maybe we go back to a vegan diet for an extra week after the cleanse if you're not a vegan now. So lots of suggestions about things you can do, playing with diet to clean it up, because I think we all want to eat better. We want a purer diet, and we all want, at least intellectually, we want a healthier lifestyle.
I agree with you. I think we do all want that, and we all should have it. And this is one good way to get some new behaviors or to change some of your food behaviors.
And I occasionally have to reboot my computer, and it solves all problems whenever I do. And this, in a way, is a kind of a rebooting or a resetting of your diet. And, you know, you have decisions to make after you start from scratch. And hopefully you don't always go back to all those bad habits. It's great for breaking bad habits.
Breaking bad habits. Very good. Thank you, Mr. Sproutman, for joining me on It's All About Food. Very happy holidays to you. And have a delicious, juicing week.
And thank you, and the same to you and everyone. And if anybody wants to join me January 5th, the post-holiday cleanse, come visit me at sproutman.com.
Sounds good. All righty, sproutman.com. I'll talk to you next year.
All the best.
Okay. Let's take a little break now, shall we? And then we'll be back talking about all kinds of interesting topics in the news that have to do about food, because it is all about food. Hello, everybody. This is the second part of It's All About Food. Thank you for joining me. I'm Karen Hartglass, and here we are on December 9th, 2014. Okay, I'm going to enjoy this next part. I get to talk about all the things that I've been reading about that I'm either excited about or concerned about or scared about. And I thought I'd share some of those thoughts with you. So you may have heard in the news or in a blog or somewhere in the media about this one North Carolina farmer, Craig Watts, who raises about 720,000 chickens, and he actually invited an organization, an animal welfare group, Compassion World Farming, to document the conditions at his farm. And, I mean, you may know that one of the crazy things about factory farming today is that people are not allowed to go in and see what's going on, and many of us have been saying the reason for that is because if we could see what was going on, if factory farms had glass walls, people wouldn't want to eat the animals that were being raised there for food, because the conditions are filthy and horrific and the animals are just treated horribly. And this one very brave farmer let this organization in. There is a video that you can watch, which is a summary of the things that they discovered. It's at Compassion and World Farming. Their website is CIWF.com. And then interestingly, surprisingly, I don't know, Purdue came in. So this farmer worked. He was contracted out and raised chickens for Purdue. And there's all kinds of rules that they have to follow in order to do this. And Purdue came in right after this expose and said, we're going to audit you now. And everyone's saying that they're doing it at kind of in a response to what had happened. But I think this is really an interesting opportunity. Nicholas Kristof in the New York Times wrote about it in the opinion pages last week. He's a brave sort. He brings up a lot of interesting topics. Sometimes I think, you know, he may be a wannabe vegan, because he brings up these things that we need to be talking about. But I come to a different conclusion when I read stories like this, when I learn about stories like this. the group, Compassion in World Farming, the people who did this expose and video, their conclusion is that factory farming needs to end. I totally agree with that. But they believe that we can create a better chicken that's treated better, and a better chicken that we can ultimately slaughter and eat. I always like to go by a phrase my dad uses very often. If you can't solve a problem, eliminate the problem. And I believe eliminating eating chickens and all animals is really the solution to this problem. The thing is, it's been getting worse over the years, where people are trying to find more ways to profit from any business. And from the livestock business, the way to profit, the way to make more of what you're selling, is unfortunately to confine these animals in very, very horrific conditions. And it's just the nature of the beast. And I would just like to see factory farming end, and we don't need to eat these poor animals. If you look at the video, I don't know how anybody could want to participate in the eating of these animals when you see what they go through. They have these raw red bellies, and some of them are so weak that they can't stand up. One of the good things that came out of this so far is that Purdue used to label their chickens as humanely raised, and they recently settled a suit with the Humane Society of the United States and have removed that line from some packaging. So, you know, it makes you wonder. Well, I don't wonder. I just don't trust these guys. Now, one thing about chicken, not just the horrific conditions that these sentient animals go through, but in order to raise chickens, we need to feed them. And everything's linked to everything else, okay? Follow me with this. We raise food, plant, for these animals to eat, and we grow the food with herbicides and pesticides. And we put arsenic in the animal feed, and there's also arsenic in some of the pesticides, and this gets concentrated in the chicken. And then later on, the chicken manure is used as fertilizer. And you know where I'm leading with this? The fertilizer is often used to grow rice. And a couple of years ago, there was a study that came out that talked about arsenic in our food, and rice had a tremendous amount and more than what was recommended that we consume, or at least the limits, although there are no federal regulated limits of how much arsenic we can get in our food. Well, Consumer Reports just came out with a new study recently, last month, in fact, and I think it's great. There's some good news and there's some not good news. And they've done more comprehensive tests on how much arsenic is in certain foods. So what do we learn from this? Well, basmati rice from India, Pakistan, or California, and sushi rice from the United States has the lowest levels of what they call inorganic arsenic compound. And and that's compared with other kinds of rice. And it's like more than half of what's found in other rice products from Texas and Louisiana, as an example, which have quite a bit more. So there is a way to have rice and avoid a significant amount of arsenic. But there's a lot of things that you do want to avoid, and the sad thing is that this impacts children a great deal, and children especially that are on gluten-free diets, because many of them go to rice products, and that includes babies, too. They're fed rice cereals, and this can be really detrimental because they can get very high doses of arsenic in their little baby bodies. And brown rice, we all love brown rice, but the problem is brown rice tends to have more arsenic in it because the arsenic tends to concentrate in the exterior part of the rice. Now, some people have gotten around this by rinsing their rice before they cook it, or rinsing or cooking it in a lot of water and draining it and rinsing it, but you lose nutrition when you do that. So there seem to be all of these compromises that we have to go through. So what? So what's the good news? The good news is they also tested other grains and pseudograins, as we call them. And the good news is amaranth, millet, and quinoa all have significantly less of this inorganic arsenic than the rice. Now, I just want to clarify something. You don't need to be a chemist to understand this, but a lot of these articles talk about arsenic, and they talk about the two main chemical types, inorganic and organic. And when we talk about organic from a chemical perspective, we're not talking about the Department of Agriculture's definition, the USDA talking about how we grow our food. We're talking about chemical terms here, and organic arsenic is talking about how the arsenic itself is hooked up in a chemical molecule. So there are two kinds, organic and inorganic, and apparently it's the inorganic forms of arsenic that are considered to be the most harmful, although it's also believed that the organic form can change into inorganic. So they both aren't good. But some of these reports specifically call out organic or inorganic. And I'm just so glad that this test was done, because when I first discovered this information about arsenic in rice, I kept saying, yeah, well, we're all scared about rice now, but what about all the other grains? And I was thinking that they probably all have high levels of arsenic, and the good news is that they don't. So double whammy here. This is another reason not to raise chickens in factory farms and feed them food that has been grown with pesticides containing arsenic, and not to add arsenic to their feed. And they do that because it's supposed to, they add the arsenic into the chicken feed because, and also to pig feed as well. It's supposed to promote growth and prevent disease. And disease is a big item in factory farms because the animals are confined. They're all very close together, and they're in a very filthy situation. So it's very easy for the disease to spread. And so what we do is we feed them all kinds of toxic chemicals to kill those diseases. And when we eat them, or if we at least get plants that are grown with manure from these animals, we get those toxic chemicals on our food. All right, so I'm looking at the end of this lovely report, and when we're talking about how many parts per billion arsenic is in some of these foods, the rices that they've compared typically are in the range of 50 to 150, and 50 being not so bad, and 150 obviously being pretty concentrated. The other grains, amaranth is at 6.2, barley 10.4, buckwheat 5.6, bulgur 8.4, farro 7.3, millet 12.1, polenta grits 4.2, and quinoa 12.5. These are significantly lower. And so that's a nice thing. Nature provides us with a variety of foods, and now we've been hearing terrible things not only about arsenic in rice, but many people now are concerned about wheat and gluten sensitivities, celiac disease. There's a whole host of reasons why people are choosing to stay away from wheat, and now we have these reasons to stay away from rice, or at least some of the rice. And there are still some pretty good, innocent and nutritious grains for us to eat. And some of my favorites are millet and buckwheat and polenta. Love polenta. Now let's talk about quinoa for a minute, shall we? And quinoa has a very low amount of arsenic in it. That's great. Quinoa is very nutritious. Quinoa has become a very sexy grain. It's very high in protein, and we see more quinoa available. It's become very mainstream. You can find salads with it, and it's often served instead of rice, and it's delicious, and it's great because it cooks quickly, too, and you can sprout it. You can eat sprouted quinoa, like a sprouted quinoa tabbouleh instead of using a bulgur wheat, and you can do lots of wonderful things with quinoa. One of the things to keep in mind when you're preparing quinoa, of course, is you need to rinse it a few times before you prepare it. Otherwise, it will have a very bitter taste because of the coating that's on the quinoa that's quite bitter. All right. Quinoa is great, isn't it? Well, every food has its story. Have you noticed how the price of quinoa is just, like, outrageous these days? So I remember when I first started buying quinoa, it was still kind of pricey at $3.99 a pound, and now I've seen it upwards at, like, $6.99 a pound, and I really can't afford it anymore. It's expensive. But the problem is bigger than that. We live in a global society, and it has its advantages and its disadvantages, and food is a big part of that. So quinoa, for a long time, has been grown in the Andean highlands of Bolivia and Peru. And there are many different varieties of quinoa, although we've only seen a few here in the United States. And unfortunately, you may have heard this, but because we're really loving quinoa up here, the farmers that are making it are getting a lot more money for it. That's good. They're able to buy cars and better houses and send their kids to school. But it's becoming more and more difficult for the locals in Bolivia and Peru to afford it. I can't afford it. They can't afford it. And it's something that they've been growing up with and living on for hundreds of years, maybe even longer. And they can't afford it anymore because of the exports. And what we eat here in the United States and many other countries has such a tremendous impact on other countries, poor countries that are growing a lot of our food. For a long time, this has been the case with sugar and coffee and tobacco, which isn't a food, but commodity products like cocoa and coffee and sugar. Farmers that have land, when they know that people want to buy things, they'll grow what people want to buy and what can be exported. And that leaves less land available to grow nutritious food, especially for the people that are growing those products in their own country. And quinoa is the new kid on the block that is causing some of these issues. So, you know, what do we do? Do we not eat quinoa? I don't really know what the solution is. One of the solutions would be to grow it where we need it. So why can't we grow some in the United States? There are people that have been trying. It's kind of difficult. I think we'll see more quinoa grown around the world. But another part of the problem is that the countries that have been growing it for a long time want to protect it and want to protect their seeds, and they don't want to share them because they don't want this food that's been such an important part of their culture and such an important part of their economy to be taken away from them. So there are issues of sharing, and I really don't know what the answer is there, but I think it would be nice if we were able to grow certain varieties of quinoa here and not have as much of an impact on those who might want to buy that food that they've been eating for so long and not be able to afford it now. Okay, so that goes into what other foods are like this. And are you familiar with maca? I remember a number of times I learned about maca. It's a root, and we get it here processed into a powder. I think I first heard about it from Brendan Brazier, the incredible athlete from Canada. I've had him on this program a number of times. He's a really nice guy, and he does excellent work. And he frequently talks about adding maca to the diet for health reasons, and it helps athletes, especially in being able to heal quickly so that they can do more workouts. It has all kinds of benefits, and it's grown in Peru, where quinoa is also grown. Apparently it's becoming another hot item outside of Peru. They're exporting a lot of it, and the price is going outrageously up, where it might have been as low as $20 a pound, and now it's $30 a pound. The country has some controls. For example, they don't export fresh maca. What they do is they process it in the country and export it out, and they do that intentionally to keep that processing work in their own countries, in their own country. And it's just incredible what we do as humans, but people are actually smuggling this maca out and bringing it to Bolivia to be processed and then shipping it over to China, where they're really interested in it over there, apparently, because it is supposed to have aphrodisiac-type properties, amongst other things. So there's this issue with maca. I haven't used it in a long time. I remember I bought a bag of maca powder, and I put it in some smoothies a really long time ago, and then I just kind of forgot about it. And it just went bad in my refrigerator. And looking at this now, I feel really bad about it because it's such a valuable food these days, and some people would kill for it probably. And Peru doesn't want to share the seeds. They don't want they don't want to share the ability to control these native species. And it's going to be interesting to see what happens with maca. Whew. Do you believe it? Every story, every food has its story. And something that I believe in is it's best as much as we can to eat locally. So we've heard about a lot of these different berries, some exotic berries from tropical areas that are so high in antioxidants, and they're really expensive, and people capitalize on this and sell all kinds of bottled drinks. You know, we can get those nutrients from foods in our own area. We don't have to go and buy these expensive exotic foods for the most part. So I say stick locally with standard foods, and don't go with these crazy trends to try foods that are supposed to be the magic cure, because they're not going to be a magic cure. They might provide some excellent nutrition, but the best way to really be healthy is to eat a whole, minimally processed, plant-based diet, organic. Avoid the things in a box, and maybe even like Steve Meyerowitz was saying, do a couple of juice fasts to give your body a break from time to time. That's it. I don't think we need to have these superfoods that may even totally disrupt in a negative way the economy of another country. Do we need to do that? Well, here we go. One last thing before I go. I love millet, and I just posted a new recipe at responsibleeatingandliving.com. It's a cereal using millet, and we don't have to eat wheat or rice at all or as often as we do. There are some wonderful grains out there, so I say meet millet. Get to know your millet, and check out the recipe that we just provided on responsibleeatingandliving.com. How about that? I think we've come to the end of another show, so I want to wish you a very, very, very delicious week. Bye-bye.